I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Craig Weiss, co-founder of Enjoy, an electronic cigarette company that sells the Enjoy King. An e-cigarette is a non-combustion cigarette that contains nicotine and strives to have the look and feel and plume of a traditional cigarette. Craig and his brother, Mark, started the company in 2006 after Mark discovered e-cigarettes, or e-cigs, on a trip to China, where they have become increasingly popular. Craig is a patent lawyer and graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
How does the e-cigarette work?
So it's an electronic nicotine delivery system. And what an electronic cigarette is it has a battery or a power source. It has a heating element. And then it has a liquid solution that contains nicotine and flavorings. And the nicotine at the end of the day is what smokers crave. And so the integrated circuit chip tells the battery to power the heating element, and then the heating element will vaporize the liquid and turn it into a vapor that is inhaled by the smoker. And then when they exhale it, it has the appearance of smoke, but in fact, it's not smoke.
The two ingredients are nicotine and polypropylene glycol. Is that correct?
Well, so different electronic cigarettes have different solutions. You have the nicotine, you have flavorings of some kind, and then either propylene glycol or glycerin or some combination of the two of them.
What kind of battery is in these cigarettes, e-cigarettes?
Yeah, so typically you would see a lithium-ion battery or a lithium polymer battery, the types of batteries technology that you'd see in pretty much every other ubiquitous consumer product that you have in America, cell phones, laptops, and the like.
Now, historically, they've been quite clunky, these e-cigarettes, and some have needed a USB port to recharge their batteries. Do your batteries need to be recharged?
No, so we took great pains to make the product as familiar as possible to a smoker. And so we made the decision to make our Enjoy King, our flagship product, disposable. So, again, to be just like a cigarette. So there's no charging. There's no plugging it in.
I want to talk about the history of e-cigarettes. It's my understanding that the first attempt by RJR Nabisco was in 1988 when they came out with their smokeless Premier, which some critics said smells like a fart.
Yeah, it wasn't a very popular product. I think they spent hundreds of millions of dollars, and it was a pretty big failure. And other companies tried as well. There was Premier, there was Eclipse, there was Accord. But all of those products were fairly large failures and didn't succeed in what the electronic cigarette industry has done in the last few years, which is to make a truly satisfying product for a smoker.
There's been some innovation in this area. In China, in the mid-90s, there was an attempt at an e-cigarette that was pretty popular. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I do know that China is what made the technology popular. But the core technology of a heating element that vaporizes a liquid is really relatively old technology, going back to the 1960s even. And it just wasn't effectuated until very recently, in the last, really 10 years or so, with this idea of marrying that concept with vaporizing nicotine.
I want to talk also about the history of cigarettes more generally.
Sure.
Where does the cigarette come from?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I can tell you that what's interesting about cigarettes are they were part of this revolution in smoking in this country. So at the turn of the last century, the way that people consumed tobacco in this country was they stuffed tobacco in their pipe or they put chew in their mouth. And then during the Industrial Revolution, you had this new invention, these machined cigarettes. And they were really made popular by World War I. And it transformed the way an entire population of people interacted with tobacco. So they went from pipe tobacco and chew to these machine cigarettes, which were initially seen as a poor man's substitute for the real thing.
Why were cigarettes made popular in World War I?
So you had basically all of these soldiers. It wasn't very convenient to get their tobacco from a pipe. It required accessories. It required, stuffing it. And there was all of these sort of accoutrements, and it wasn't certainly very flexible or easy on a battlefield. And so when these machine cigarettes came out, and they were, of course, given away to the soldiers as they were in World War II, Then all of the soldiers returned home after the war, and they had grown accustomed to the, you know, the machine cigarette.
So it was the war effort that popularized cigarettes.
Correct.
In the 1950s, cigarettes had a second chapter.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So the second revolution in the way that smokers interacted with their tobacco happened in the early 1950s. You had Reader's Digest, which was the leading news publication of the day, published their feature story called Cancer by the Carton, and it really shone a light on the tobacco industry. And so they responded with the creation of filtered cigarettes. And at the time, all of the cigarettes that were in existence are what we would today call unfiltered cigarettes. The filter, which was this response to health concerns, was considered when it was initially introduced to be artificial, fake. It was considered to be very feminine. And Marlboro was introduced as a woman's cigarette, ivory tips to protect the lips. And then you had this amazing thing happen in the 1950s where they introduced, in essence, new and improved technology. Now, the filter, of course, didn't ever really do a good job of filtering. There was a perception that it was better for you, but of course it wasn't. But the perception was that it was a new and improved filter. There was a masculinization of the product with, of course, most famously the Marlboro Man. And within the span of about 5 to 7 years, filtered cigarettes went from 2-3% of the market to 50% of the market.
Thanks mostly to the genius of this shift in the marketing campaign by Marlboro or Philip Morris that changed the cigarettes from being feminine, protect the lips, to being cowboys and masculine.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So similar to this pivot moment in cigarettes history, we're now facing a pivot moment in the e-cigarette history where there's some backlash and people are reluctant to adopt e-cigarettes. Why are people more willing to do so now than, let's say, 5 years ago?
So this is really a technology story. 5 years ago, an electronic cigarette cost $200, was a large, bulky device, required assembly, required charging. Today, you can find electronic cigarettes for under $10, like the ones that we sell. They're simple, they're easy, much better flavor, much better technology. And so in a very short period of time, we've done what Americans do. We use technology to try to solve really complicated, intractable problems. And as the technology continues to improve, you're going to see this larger and larger adoption of the new technology.
It seems to be attractive from a cost perspective as well, because you don't have the same types of taxes burdening e-cigarettes as the tobacco industry does.
Correct. There's almost no one is taxing electronic cigarettes globally. There's only one state in the United States, Minnesota, that's taxed electronic cigarettes. Several other states have tried and failed to get that passed. And the reason why they failed is because you have this amazing grassroots movement among electronic cigarette users, these people who show up at state legislatures and they say, hey, I was a pack-a-day smoker for 30 years, and if you tax this and make it more expensive for me to use, you're going to drive me back to cigarettes. And on the strength of that type of grassroots movement, they voted down taxes in multiple states now.
Incidentally, what is the difference between tobacco and nicotine?
So that's a great question. Nicotine is derived from tobacco typically, although it doesn't necessarily have to be. Nicotine could be created synthetically. Nicotine could be derived from tomatoes or lettuce or potatoes. It occurs in nature. The tobacco leaf is a leaf. But the tobacco leaf is the most efficient way to get nicotine because it occurs in abundance naturally.
Where do you get your nicotine?
It's something that we haven't talked about publicly just because there's a little bit of a proprietary benefit or a trade secret to the way that we procure our nicotine. But for us, one of the most important features is our ability to make sure that we have a process by which we can provide the nicotine in the cleanest way.
Although I have seen you buy an awful large number of tomatoes, so.
You never know.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Craig Weiss, co-founder of Enjoy, a company that makes the e-cigarette Enjoy King. You've had a team of people who have been instrumental. One is Mark Scatterday. Can you talk about him briefly?
Sure. Mark Scatterday, he's my Johnny Ive. He's just an incredible designer.
Johnny Ive referring to Steve Jobs' designer at Apple, who was instrumental for Jobs.
Exactly. So Mark is that for me. He's just has an incredible design sense. he himself is an entrepreneur. And when I recruited him, he first started just doing it as a favor to help me and give me some of his design expertise. And when I said, Mark, I need you, he said, well, Craig, I haven't had a job since I was 15. Because he was always the employer, never the employee. He was always running his own companies.
Most recently being the grip stress ball.
Yeah, so that famous grip stress ball that we're all familiar with, the birdseed wrapped in a balloon that's been out for so long, he sold 30 million pieces over a 20-year period of that product. And so I told him, I need you. And we're really now focused on the design of the product. And so to answer your question, what's really made the product successful today is the commitment that we made internally that we wanted to make a product that was going to replicate as close as possible the cigarette smoking experience. And the reason for that is you've got something around 44 million Americans who smoke. It's almost 20% of the adult population. And our thought was, if we're going to try to get them to change a habit, and not just any habit, but a really entrenched habit that many of them take literally with them to their graves, we need to be able to narrow that bridge to familiarity so to make it so short that it's easy to cross.
What has surprised you about the elements involved in replicating that cigarette? Like, what is more important to people than you might have thought when you first started this endeavor in a cigarette?
I was surprised, having never been a smoker, I was surprised about the throat hit. So I learned this expression about the throat hit, and the throat hit was very important to smokers. And the reason why is because the scratchiness that they feel in the back of their throat is a little bit Pavlovian, but it indicates to them that they're about to experience the nicotine that they crave. And so that was a surprise to me that something that I would think would be something you'd want to eliminate was actually coveted by smokers.
I've also read somewhere that the visual element of seeing smoke, the more smoke the better, was also something that surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the reason why I think one of the main reasons why the nicotine replacement therapies haven't been successful over the last 30 years is because they don't replicate the ritual of smoking. So being able to do hand-to-mouth and being able to generate the what looks like smoke is very important to smokers. And so we realized that with all of the electronic cigarettes on the market, including our own previous OneJoy, they were just too big and too heavy, and they couldn't even be held in your hand in between your fingers the way a smoker was accustomed to.
Environmentally, you know, we have cigarette butts on the sidewalk that are ubiquitous. Are e-cigs going to be, do they shrink?
No. So, cigarette butts is the number one form of litter in the United States. Our product has this lithium-ion battery. We have a recycling program at Enjoy. So we encourage our customers, if they send us back 8 spent electronic cigarettes, we'll send them back 1 free Enjoy to encourage them to send us back the product so we can recycle the batteries.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Craig Weiss, co-founder of the electronic cigarette company Enjoy. We'll hear more from Craig coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Craig Weiss, co-founder of Enjoy, a company that makes the e-cigarette Enjoy King. An e-cigarette is made to have close to the look and feel and nicotine of a real cigarette, but without the tobacco and smoke that causes the majority of the health complications. The company won a lawsuit in 2010 against the FDA, which freed it from the agency's regulation. What is the story behind, the founding of Enjoy?
Sure. So my brother Mark and I practiced law together. In fact, the 4 oldest sons were all IP attorneys, and we all practiced at the same law firm that my father had founded almost 40 years ago. And we considered ourselves very entrepreneurial. And in 2005 and both 2005 and 2006, Mark traveled to China. And he saw a crude version of an electronic cigar, at least what we would call today an electronic cigar, at a trade show. He thought that this would make a great product in America, especially if somehow they could ever get the technology such that they could get the size down to a cigarette.
So he came up with the idea, but it was your firm that founded Enjoy, right?
Well, the founding of Enjoy was a venture of the firm. So as a firm, we did lots of entrepreneurial things. So the firm incorporated the company, and so the firm subsidized the entrepreneurial efforts of all of its members.
Does he smoke? Do you smoke? Does anyone in your family smoke?
No, Mark doesn't smoke. I don't smoke. No one in the family smokes. And originally, I think it was seen as more of just a market opportunity. It's an $80 billion market in the United States. It's an $800 billion market globally.
The cigarette market.
The cigarette market.
Now, you are an entrepreneurial family, and throughout your life, as you were growing up, your father would file patents for ideas you came up with. What were some of the ideas that your father patented?
The first idea I came up with that he thought was worthy enough to file a patent application on, I came up with when I was 12 or 13, and we came from a big tennis-playing family. My brother Mark and my brother Farley were both professional tennis players. Hmm. And so I came up with this idea for a netting system so that if you were going to practice tennis with those tennis ball machines that spray the balls everywhere, they would hit this net and funnel to the center and make it easy to clean up. I was teased mercilessly by my brothers for coming up with an invention that they thought was a testament to my laziness. So I got that patent when I was, I believe, 13. And then when I was 18, I had my wisdom teeth out. So I went to the oral surgeon to get my four wisdom teeth out. And he said, you got to keep ice on your face for 12 hours tomorrow. And so after walking around with hands on my cheeks with ice packs, I thought, this is crazy. So I came up with ice that I had put in Ziploc bags, and then I got like a headband, and I figured out this way to secure it all to my face. Mm. And I ended up getting two patents on this medical device for an ice cooling method for different parts of your body that would be hands-free.
Were any of your ideas or your brother and sister's ideas, and by the way, you come from a family of seven.
Yes.
Brothers and sisters, were they ever marketable?
Yes. So my sister Felicia had an idea when she was very young, too. She had a cold, and she accidentally dropped her chapstick into her tissue box, and she thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if the tissues were coated with a chapstick? And she got a patent on that, and she ended up licensing it or selling it to a larger company and made money from doing it.
So did you have the feeling that, you know what, I am going to be an entrepreneur and run a company one day, although you were not practicing that because you were at your father's law firm?
Yeah, you know, the big change for me happened about 5.5 years ago when my father passed away. He'd been really the rainmaker of the firm, and he was not just my partner and my father, but, you know, my mentor. And it was a bit of an eye-opener that I felt my safety net was gone, and fear is a great motivator. And so I started to think about how am I going to take responsibility for growing this business, that at the time being the law firm. I joined a couple of organizations. I joined EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, mm-hmm. and Vistage, which is another kind of CEO training type of organization. And so initially for the first couple of years, I was just focused on how do I grow my law firm. And it was only when I started to see with the FDA litigation with Enjoy, which obviously I felt I had some knowledge of as an attorney, that I started to look more at Enjoy and through the lens of this entrepreneurial endeavor with these organizations, I started to see myself possibly being able to add value there.
In addition to helping to run your father's law firm, you also started a hedge fund predicting patent outcomes. Can you talk more about the impetus for starting that fund?
The other thing that I think happened that probably helped push me in this role was my youngest brother was a day trader. And I always say day traders typically don't care whether stocks go up or down as long as they respond violently. And he started to notice that the most volatile stocks were these publicly traded companies that were involved in material IP litigation. And he thought, well, wait a second, my brothers are patent attorneys. If they could read the briefs and go to court and tell me who was going to win, I could make a fortune. And so that became the genesis of this idea of how do we leverage our expertise as IP lawyers in this world of the stock market and trading. And I created this hedge fund.
And what were some of your most successful cases?
Probably one of our most successful cases was we did TiVo versus EchoStar, which was a big one right out of the gate. TiVo had sued EchoStar for infringing on their DVR technology patents. And so we went to that case, and TiVo won. And we were in the courtroom when that happened, and were able to successfully trade off of that news. We both predicted they were going to win, and also were there when it actually happened.
Were you running the hedge fund contemporaneous with the Enjoy lawsuit with the FDA?
When I was running the hedge fund, I was still practicing law. The FDA litigation was happening concurrently, And my oldest brother, Jeff, and I, with our hedge fund experience, felt that we had ideas about what was the best way to manage that litigation, and we tried to pass on that information to the then management of the company. And I think it was during that time that we started to feel a little bit frustrated that we knew best how that litigation should be managed, and the management wasn't necessarily heeding our counsel. And that's what led to this annual shareholder meeting in 2010, which is when I became president officially.
You became CEO in 2010, which was new for you. How do you think you were able to do it so well?
I had an incredible mentor, and he was the guy who I had been friends with for 10 years, and I asked him to be the chairman of the board of Enjoy, Ellie Wortman. And Ellie had been one of the partners at Benchmark Capital, and they'd done eBay and Twitter, and he himself at 29 was the CEO of a $1.8 billion publicly traded NASDAQ company. And as he often reminded me, he said, yeah, and I did that, and I didn't have me as a mentor. but I had him as a mentor, yeah. And I leaned very heavily on him.
How do you know Ellie Wortman?
So I was living in Israel in the year 2000, and my oldest brother Jeff and I had co-authored a book together about the Americans and Canadians who fought in Israel's war for independence in 1948. They were all World War II GIs for the most part, and 3 years after World War II, they went to fight for what they thought was another good fight, which ended up being the creation of the State of Israel. So the book is called I Am My Brother's Keeper, and we were fortunate enough to get the sitting Prime Minister of Israel to write the foreword at the time, which was Benjamin Netanyahu. And so I was giving a speech in Jerusalem about the book, and Ellie was in attendance and came up to me afterwards and congratulated me on the book. And we struck up a conversation which turned into a friendship.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Craig Weiss, co-founder of Enjoy, a company that makes the e-cigarette Enjoy King. I want to shift to the lawsuit because that seems to be an important moment in the company's well-being and existence, frankly. Can you explain that?
Sure. In 2009, the FDA directed U.S. Customs to cease shipments of our product and a competitor's product, and they tried to claim that they were unapproved drug delivery devices. We filed a lawsuit against the FDA claiming that this was an inappropriate exercise of their drug jurisdiction because we didn't make any health claims or therapeutic claims or cessation claims about our product. In the midst of our litigation, Congress passed the first landmark tobacco legislation in 30 years, the 2009 Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act. And the judge in our case agreed with us and granted an injunction saying if the FDA wanted to regulate electronic cigarettes, it could only do so under its tobacco authority that Congress had granted it in 2009. Hmm. And so we won an injunction against the FDA saying that they could not use their drug jurisdiction, and the FDA appealed. And then at the end of 2010, we won our appeal 3-0.
And this was after $2 million of legal fees.
Exactly.
People contend that you really saved the e-cigarette category, and it was with your patent know-how that you really were able to do this.
Well, the knowledge that we had of litigation from the hedge fund was most beneficial. And at the end of the day, I do believe that Enjoy can appropriately take credit for creating the electronic cigarette category, or at least the legal framework for it to exist.
Now, from the inception, you did not mention the potential health benefits of e-cigarettes. Is it because you were conscious of this government chaos that would ensue?
Yeah, that was one of the brilliant ideas of Mark. As a lawyer, he was well aware that if you make health claims or therapeutic claims or cessation claims, that the FDA can classify you as a drug. And he knew it was critical that we avoid that. And because the company did avoid that, we avoided the drug jurisdiction that would come with it.
There was a New York Magazine article about you in 2013 in the summer, and they talked about healthy Pringles, the story of Pringles coming out with a rice-based chip that seemed to be healthier, but it didn't do well because people crave fat and they want just something bad. How much was that in your mind, not necessarily the Pringles example, but how much was, you know, cigarettes being kind of maverick and cool, how much was that in your mind when you wanted to not go there to the health benefits?
So, you know, there's something very interesting that's going on in our society, which is the products that are better for you, that are marketed as this is the healthy alternative, are not nearly as big a categories as the products that are marketed as you deserve this or go for it or that where there's no health message. You see that whether it's fast food versus diet food. You see that whether even in the tobacco space. So you've got $600 to $800 billion global tobacco market, and the global market for the healthy alternative, nicotine replacement therapy, is under $3 billion. So as a result, we see that over and over again. And I remember we used to have this debate early on: even if we could make health claims, maybe we wouldn't, for this reason.
I want to touch on advertising for a minute. In a way, television or TV stations are allergic to advertise e-cigarettes because of the ban on advertising cigarettes. But in 2013, you had your first Super Bowl ad. Can you talk about the import of that?
Sure. So what we found when we first went to the television stations with our commercial is there was some obvious initial resistance because there's been a ban on cigarette television advertising since 1970, and we talked to them about the fact that we weren't a cigarette, we have no tobacco, we're not burning, and we didn't meet the legal definition that would prohibit our ability to advertise on television. And on the strength of that argument, we started to pick up more and more local affiliates in different stations. And for the Super Bowl in 2013, we were able to advertise our commercial in 5 markets across the U.S., and probably in about 10 million people were able to see that commercial.
It reminds me of the 1984 ad that Apple put out when the Macintosh was coming out, also during a Super Bowl, and that was transformative. The words were, I think, "You'll learn why 1984 won't be like 1984, George Orwell illusion. And with the advent of the Macintosh, you're democratizing computers in a way that where Big Brother will not be able to control the masses." Was that in your mind at all?
Absolutely. And it's a wonderful analogy, right? Because our Big Brother equivalent is Big Tobacco. And so for us, we're trying to send a message that we are not Big Tobacco and we're out to obsolete the cigarette.
You've made a couple of Apple Steve Jobs allusions. One was to Johnny Ive, his right-hand design man. Did you just read the Steve Jobs biography?
No, so I've been using Apple products since I was maybe 10 years old. So I've actually, for almost probably about 30 years, I've been using Apple products. So for me, I was a true believer. I mean, I did something else very entrepreneurial, and typically everyone tells you not to do this. But I remember reading about this idea that if you believe that some company is going to ultimately be successful and take over the world, that you shouldn't diversify. You should kind of push all in. And so in 2002, I thought, that company is Apple. I've used their products for 20 years. I've always loved what they've done. And I took my entire retirement savings and I bought Apple stock. So I really put my money where my mouth was in Apple. So I've been a big Apple fan for a long time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Craig Weiss, co-founder of Enjoy, a company that makes the e-cigarette Enjoy King. What has been, aside from the successful lawsuit against the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, what has been a turning point in the company's short history for you?
So when we won our case against the FDA, we took that legal victory to wholesale. We went to McLane, the largest wholesaler in the country, and we said, we're the gold standard in the industry. We're focused only on the most responsible business practices, and we're the only electronic cigarette company in the country that has an injunction against the FDA that they cannot regulate us as a drug delivery product. And on the strength of those arguments, we got into McLane. They're a $34 billion Berkshire Hathaway company, and that relationship helped propel us to get into the convenience stores. And if there's $80 billion in cigarettes sold in the United States every year, 75% of that sold in 140,000 convenience stores.
And we're talking about 7-Eleven.
7-Eleven, Circle K, in the Northeast, you've got Hess and Wawa, and you've got Chevron and Sunoco, so all of these types of chains, yes. And then it became a bit of a snowball. So as we gained success with 7-Eleven and Circle K and other retailers, now we're in Walmart, we're in Walgreens, we're able to gain that foothold. We're in Costco to get that national footprint.
This is your life right now, although you do have family. You have 2 children, and you're married. I see you have a wedding band, and it has some Hebrew writing on it. What is the Hebrew say?
There's 3 words. It says Gam Ze Yavor, and it means "this too shall pass." And the story behind it is there's a jeweler in Jerusalem. So my wife and I met in Jerusalem. We were both there on junior year of college abroad. And so we met there, we fell in love there. We lived there for almost 4 years altogether. And so it was a very special place in our heart for both of us. And there's this this story about the jeweler who he made the ring for a king, and it's a fictitious story. It's a fable, basically. But the king wanted a ring that would make him feel happy when he was sad, and when he was happy, kind of bring him back down to earth. And so this idea was, you know, this too shall pass. You could use in both contexts. So when things are bad, it's going to be okay. And when things are, you're riding high, not to lose sight of the fact that, that those highs are also going to pass. And it's important to think about the big picture.
That's very interesting. Anything else on the personal front like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, one of my primary motivations with NJOY is I have a 4-year-old daughter, I have a 6-year-old son, and I want them to grow up in a world where they can say to me, so wait a second, I don't understand. So you used to light these things on fire and then you'd put them in your mouth? I mean, how did that not burn your face? And so that's a big motivator for me. And I think about it also from the humanitarian context of this idea of, you know, my wife's actually a rabbi. And so I'd like to think that we're relatively spiritual people. And the highest and most important thing you can do in Judaism, at least, is this idea of saving a life and repairing the world. Those are very big contexts.
Tikkun Olam.
Exactly.
Which means?
Repairing the world. So that's this idea of Tikkun Olam, repairing the world, is a big principle in Judaism. And so I like this idea of repairing the world.
By the way, we talked a lot about your father. What about your mom? She birthed 7 of you.
my mom is an incredible woman. In fact, I think, you know, arguably there should be a show just about her. She not only gave birth to children in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and literally was 2 months shy of her 47th birthday when she gave birth to my little brother, but she was also a federal judge for 25 years.
So she was 8 years old when she gave birth?
Exactly. Yeah, a little bit older. But the children that she gave birth to were quite remarkable. So my sister Gail, the oldest, has a PhD from Yale. She's the chair of the philosophy department at George Washington University. My sister Felicia has a PhD in clinical psychology. The next 4 boys, of which I'm the youngest of those 4, all IP attorneys, you know, 2 of them a professional tennis player, Farley a professional tennis player. And my youngest brother, the day trader who had the idea for the hedge fund.
And you?
Yeah, I'm in there somewhere.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
My guest has been Craig Weiss, co-founder of NJOY. Coming up, we'll meet Alex Counts, founder and president of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to make loans to small business owners in almost 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Alex founded the Grameen Foundation in 1997 after working with the pioneer of microfinance, Muhammad Yunus, at the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Alex is the author of Small Loans, Big Dreams. Welcome.
Thank you.
What does Grameen mean?
Grameen, actually, many people think it's the name of the founder of the bank. And in fact, it is just a word in the Bengali language, which roughly translates as rural or village. And Grameen Bank was set up in Bangladesh to fill the gaps in lending. And one of the gaps were there wasn't nearly enough lending in the rural areas and the villages. So that led to the name evolving as the Grameen Bank.
Now, Muhammad Yunus is considered the pioneer of microfinance. What form did microfinance have prior to his coming on the scene?
Well, I think, you know, there's always been lending to people who wouldn't qualify for whatever the traditional lending, bank lending of that era was. People can go back to biblical times. But institutionalizing it, the way I think of it is Ray Kroc didn't invent the hamburger, but he did something with it that no one ever done before.
The founder of McDonald's?
The founder of McDonald's. But Dr. Yunus didn't invent lending to the poor, but he actually institutionalized it, franchised it, if you will, in a way that no one had ever done.
When did you first learn about microfinance or about Muhammad Yunus?
When I was at Cornell in the mid-80s, one of the things very striking of that era was there was a lot of student protest. It was Reagan administration, liberal campus, and people were protesting apartheid. And I just saw that I got no energy from working against things I didn't like. And through a series of discussions with mentors, I said, I want to find out on issues of poverty and injustice what was working in the world. Dr. Yunus and Grameen Bank came onto my radar screen, and it all started with a letter I wrote him my junior year where I basically kind of laid out how I thought I could help him expand on a global scale.
What exactly did the letter say?
Well, I'm sure if I could dig the letter up from his files, I'd be embarrassed by it in many ways because I think I more or less proposed what must have sounded like the Yunus Counts plan to eradicate global poverty. Very simplistic and grandiose, and saying that I'd figured something out over beer and pizza one night in my, you know, on the campus, which is that if Grameen Bank could be applied in all the countries where poverty was pervasive, that you could really start to roll back global poverty. And despite the oversimplification and kind of grandiosity of it, he wrote me back and he told me that I should first come and learn everything about Grameen and I should try to learn the language of Bangladesh before I got there. And I was so encouraged that he took the time to write me back that that's exactly what I did.
Were you surprised to get the letter back from him or were you like, yeah, of course, that's a good idea?
I was pretty surprised. What I was more surprised with is not that he replied, but he really took my idea seriously. And he saw the germ of something really good within me. And I think that's his secret. I think when he walks into a village, you know, he looks at a beggar woman and he sees a businesswoman. And so helps bring out of people their highest potential. So when he saw me reaching probably much farther than I had any right to about what I could do addressing global poverty, he saw in me that even without ever looking me in the eye, that I could do it. And of course, that set me and, you know, got me very excited.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. So you get a reply from Muhammad Yunus and he says, come to Bangladesh. So after graduation, you hopped on a plane, and what happens next?
Well, I'd been fortunate. Both Cornell had a very dynamic language program, so I picked up some Bengali before I got there, which surprised everyone. And it was interesting because I went on a Fulbright scholarship, and there were delegations from the U.S. Embassy and Grameen Bank that went to pick me up. And I had a choice right there, what lifestyle, and I went with the Grameen folks. And for my first year there, I had almost no contact with Americans. I immersed myself in everything Grameen and really became an insider there.
What do you remember specifically? What are some examples of that year, things that surprised you,
yeah,
things that weren't as set up as well as you thought? Or,
well, I think that when I first went out to the villages with Professor Yunus, how he was regarded as something of a kind of a savior, a hero in rural Bangladesh, and the closeness of the loan officers. You know, Dr. Yunus once said to me that if a branch manager who's been in his post for a year doesn't know the names of all the children of the 1,500 borrowers and their husbands' names, then he isn't doing his job because he's just basically doing a transaction. He's not taking the interest he needs to in their overall well-being. But really, when I saw how, and my language skills got good enough to really draw out of women in conversations how they turn $40 or a $60 loan to do something as simple as make cottage cheese and sell it to the shops in Dhaka. When I could draw that out of people in one-on-one conversations, I said, there's something about this that's so elegant, so simple, and works well. And so that was very striking, that, again, banking, but so much more.
You started Grameen Foundation in 1997. Mm-hmm. Professor Yunus is on the board. And he gave you or lent you $6,000?
Well, what he did do is around the time that we were setting it up, he had won a prize, but while he was waiting to bring the money into Bangladesh, he had earned some interest in an interest-bearing account. So he gave me the interest, and he said, this is your seed money to start Grameen Foundation. And so we turned that somehow or other into $100,000 in the first year. So like many things associated with Grameen, it started very small, but it ends up being pretty substantial.
How old were you in 1997 when you started Grameen Foundation?
I just turned 30.
What were some of the kind of important stepping stones in those in that critical early period? Like some important turning points for you?
To begin with, I really wasn't a good fundraiser at all. So a couple times we almost ran out of money. At one point, our auditor told us that our bank balance was down to $200, and I had like six or seven staff at the time. So we were that close to being insolvent. A couple times I didn't even pay myself a salary for 3-4 months in a row, so we didn't run out of money. But I met kind of fortuitously in early 2000, I had a number of microfinance leaders who were applying the Grameen methodology in India, and they said, we need $1 million. And if you give us $1 million by the end of the year, we'll do great things. We can add more than 100,000 borrowers, but we need that up front. And this was what we were set up to do, but I was so intimidated, I was, you know, barely able to keep the lights on at the time. And I joined forces with Steve Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's grandson, who said he was willing to help me, and we literally raised $1 million in 3 weeks.
How did you meet Steve Rockefeller?
I was invited at the time. Bankers Trust, which later became part of Deutsche Bank, was setting up a microfinance fund, kind of a quasi-commercial, quasi-philanthropic fund. And they were looking for someone new to the field. And so they asked me if I was willing to join the board as an advisor. And he was on the board. And we hit it off. A little mesmerized by his charisma and the name, I said, that's a fun guy I'm going to try to call and have coffee with. And within a year or so, that concrete project came on. I was panicked about how we were going to ever meet this goal. And I got up my courage to ask him to help me. And he said yes. It was really during that time with Steve's mentorship that I found my voice as a fundraiser. And one of the things I realized is that I was giving these wealthy people an opportunity to be part of something really important for meaning, for accomplishment that they wouldn't be able to have without me. And suddenly fundraising went from trying to take something from someone and leaving them with less, but really realizing that we're doing a deal with them, we're leaving them with more.
Yeah.
And I never looked back.
You had another turning point after raising $1 million with the help of Steve Rockefeller a couple years later, where you built your first credit facility, where you created leveraged pools of capital. You were able to raise roughly $30 million, which then could be leveraged to $140 million to loan. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, actually, I mentioned earlier that I raised $1 million with Steve Rockefeller, and we set out to raise $1 million the following year, and we weren't able to do that. We raised only a quarter of that amount for India. This was 2001. The economy had contracted and after the 9/11 attacks. So we were trying to scratch our heads. How do we get more leverage out of a reduced amount? And people thought about, what if we use the money we raised to give some sort of a partial guarantee to Indian banks to lend to these micro-lending organizations, lend them $1 million, and they could then use that to give out a lot of $100 loans, and we would be a kind of a partial guarantor because we had reduced amount of capital. And it actually worked. We used $250,000 to leverage $2.5 million. So that planted a seed of, my God, we're on to something here. And it might be not just in India. So we did a kind of a long shot. We pulled all these people together in the home of a venture capitalist, John Doerr. Founded Clarion Perkins, was one of the early investors in Amazon and many of the really great West Coast companies, legendary venture capitalist. And people said, well, what could we actually do now that we've learned about the possibilities of microfinance? And he said, well, I'm told by the Grameen staff that if we were to collectively pledge 0.1% of our net worth, not give it, but pledge it to this loan guarantee pool, they could bring tens of millions of dollars, and probably we would never need to give them a cent, but we need to be willing to lose that amount. And that, people said, well, I might be willing to do that. And so it took us 10 months once we got the mandate from this group, but we were able to put together the facility, and they pledged collectively $31 million, and that allowed us over 5 years where we were able to leverage more than $150 million, and there was not a single default, and it's funded on more than a million microloans.
And you had this meeting at John Doerr's house 8 days after your father died. Talk to me about the intensity of that period.
Well, it was, you know, this is something we'd been building towards. A fundraising colleague, Barb Weber, also a good friend, put it together. And it was so improbable. We weren't that on that strong financial footing at the time, Grameen Foundation. My father's health was uncertain, and I wasn't even sure I was able to go. It was the meeting that had been years in the planning. And yet somehow we pulled it off. And what was interesting was I found myself so kind of emotionally depleted, having just come from my father's funeral, and that one or two of my staff and one of my board members really took up the leadership role I play. I was very much in the background, and so it was a very complex, exciting negotiation with these 25 individuals who were there, and one that I just got to kind of sit back and observe the team that I'd assembled negotiate that with some of the people, the leaders of industry, and yet doing it really as peers, and that was thrilling.
Grameen Bank and Grameen Foundation is creating ancillary benefits other than simple poverty reduction, for example, decrease in domestic violence or a dissipation of, let's say, Hindu-Muslim conflicts. What are some examples of that?
When I was researching my book, Small Loans, Big Dreams, I met a woman, Amina Begum, who was one of the newest recruits in that village. And one of the things that was really striking is that, well, she had been didn't own any of her own land, nor did her husband, and so she was quite entrepreneurial, raising chickens and livestock, and yet as we learned and we interviewed her over time, sometimes when her husband wasn't there, that she said that her husband, frustrated with their poverty, had often taken in the past to beating her, and actually showed a place where she'd been beaten with a bicycle chain and a scar under her chin that wasn't easily visible. And yet she explained this story that once she joined Grameen, she'd kind of gone into a little bit of a agreement with her other borrowing members who said they were going to come by. And knowing that the husband really liked having the working capital for the businesses that they went in together, that they told the husband kind of off the cuff that Grameen had a rule that if there was any abuse and beating in any household, that the loan capital was immediately cut off, which wasn't actually a rule. But they kind of scared him, and from that moment forward, that he neither beat her nor the children because he was afraid of losing the access to that capital. I thought about this village where there was a lot of centuries of the Hindus and Muslims living peacefully together, but in recent decades getting more tense, especially as there were conflicts within India, where it's a Hindu majority, and many of the Hindus that were a little more prosperous were leaving and migrating to India, and it was really leaving a hole in the social fabric of this village, Kolshi, in Bangladesh, which was the name of the village. And yet when Grameen came in and started forming these solidarity groups, borrowing groups, the only way you could do it in most cases was to have groups that were both Hindus and Muslims together, women. And they began to socialize more and establish bonds of friendship. And what was interesting is that when I went back 10 years later to this village in Bangladesh where I lived and worked and was researching my book, is that more or less from that time onward, when Grameen had been around for a few years, the whole flight of the Hindus to India had stopped.
What is the default rate among the people you're lending to?
Except in cases of immediately after a natural disaster, typical default rates are 2-3%. So basically the same, more or less the same on commercial loans in the United States.
What percent of the recipients are women?
You look at the organizations that Grameen Foundation supports, the majority of them are 100% women borrowers. And of the rest, it's anywhere between 50 and 90%. microlending, and the research shows this, and my own personal journeys to slums and villages, is that the women make better credit risks. They also use the profit to help give the children of the next generation the best chance to emerge from poverty by investing in health and education and nutrition of that next generation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there ever any stigma or trouble that results or resentment among the men because the women are receiving sometimes 100% of microfinance credit?
There's often tension. In fact, in many villages, one that I spent a lot of time in Bangladesh, the men in the village for 6 months didn't allow Grameen to operate. They said, we don't think this is a right kind of bank if you only lend to women. And so Grameen said, well, we'll wait around for a little while, but ultimately we'll just pull up stakes and go. And the men were like, well, this is the only place to get credit at a fair rate. And if you have this crazy policy about lending to women, I guess that's okay. And so, you know, there is tension, and then sometimes there's tension within the family. The man wants to use the loan for another different purpose than the woman applied for it. And this is where the group solidarity comes in, where if a woman is approached by her husband to divert the loan to another purpose, she goes and gets her friends in her borrowing group, and they come and try to convince the husband. And if that doesn't work, the other women bring their husbands. And if that doesn't work, you bring the staff from the bank so that the money goes into the productive uses that everyone agreed with. One of the things that men, if you talk to men who have had their women come into microfinance, is they'll say something like, I had no idea that my wife had this ability in business. And when she started working in business and earning income, it took pressure off me to have to provide for all the needs of the family. And it was a little shocking to see that part of her come out. But the microloan made it possible, and I saw a whole new side to my wife that I'd never seen before.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that makes loans to small business owners across the globe. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.